Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with accusations in a lawsuit against Fox News by a former longtime Fox News contributor that implicates Sean Spicer and President Trump in an effort to deflect attention from connections between Russian intelligence and WikiLeaks, who released stolen data hacked from the DNC that was damaging to Hillary Clinton's campaign. Paul Fahey, the Washington Post media reporter, joins us to discuss his latest article, Sean Spicer claimed to be unaware of Seth Rich's story after meeting with donor who pushed it, and how the tragic murder of a DNC IT staffer, Seth Rich, was used to whip up a conspiracy theory pushed by Fox News and the White House that Seth Rich was the source of the hacked DNC emails, not the Russians and WikiLeaks. Then we'll look into the extent that Donald Trump might go to sabotage the Affordable Care Act in order to prove his constant refrain that it is collapsing by withholding payments of subsidies to health insurers for low-income customers and by generally creating uncertainty in the insurance market to hasten its collapse. Gerald Kaminsky, a professor of health policy and management and director of the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research, joins us to discuss the fate and future of Obamacare and a new report that monthly covered California premiums will rise by an average of 12.5%, with Anthem Blue Cross announcing it plans to end its ACA coverage in most of California. Then finally, we'll assess the fallout from last week's ousting of Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif by the Supreme Court on the basis of corruption charges exposed in the Panama Papers. Shuja Nawaz, the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within, joins us to discuss whether the former cricket star Imran Khan, who has campaigned for Sharif's removal from office, will benefit from this latest removal of an elected leader that many suspect has been engineered by Pakistan's powerful army, which many believe covertly supports Imran Khan. And joining us now is Paul Fahey, who's the Washington Post media reporter, whose latest article is Sean Spicer claimed to be unaware of Seth Rich's story after meeting with donor who pushed it. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Fahey.
Thank you, Ian.
And can you walk us through this Byzantine story?
Yes, Byzantine is the word for it. It's quite convoluted and complex. Let me take a shot at it. Last summer, a young fellow named Seth Rich was murdered in D.C. This gave rise to a conspiracy theory that Seth Rich, who worked for the DNC, had leaked embarrassing emails, embarrassing to Hillary Clinton, to WikiLeaks, which then published them. There's no basis, in fact, for any of this. Nevertheless, this conspiracy theory has been pushed by supporters of President Trump. Today, Rod Wheeler, who is an investigator on the story, filed a lawsuit claiming that Fox News, which had published some of this conspiracy stuff, was working in concert with the White House to promulgate these kinds of accusations, and that President Trump himself was aware of a bogus story that Fox News had published advancing this conspiracy theory. So that's basically the long and short of it. It gets a little more complicated, but that's the essence.
And who is suing who?
Rod Wheeler, again, an investigator of this Seth Rich murder, is suing Fox News, the Fox News reporter who wrote this story on Fox's website, and a third party, a businessman who had engaged Rod Wheeler's services and had pushed him to present the information as the conspiracy that was favorable to Trump. So there are three defendants whom Wheeler has named.
And that would be the Republican donor, Ed Butowski.
That's exactly right. Ed Butowski is a wealthy businessman. He's been a donor to President Trump and other Republican candidates. He is the one who has allegedly been saying that this has been all a big conspiracy to murder Seth Rich by the Democratic National Committee.
So that sort of goes back to the Vince Foster scenario, right? It's the idea that they killed their own.
Well, that's right. I think the more recent parallel is Comet Ping Pong, this notion that there was a conspiracy to run a child molestation ring out of the restaurant in D.C., that this was revealed somehow in the WikiLeaks emails. Of course, that was bogus and discredited, much the way this has been. But the allegations keep coming, and Rod Wheeler here, who initially, advanced this notion, is now turning on the very people he was in league with and saying, "No, this is a false conspiracy."
And of course, the conspiracy theory about the pizza place being a child porn ring run by Hillary Clinton. That wasn't exactly harmless, was it? Somebody, in fact, I think it was General Flynn's son was pushing that story and led some fellow with a gun to go and shoot the place up.
That's correct. A young man came in November after the election and supposedly was investigating these conspiracies for himself, went into the restaurant, fired a number of shots. He was arrested and has been convicted of, assault with a deadly weapon.
So let's focus in on your story then in the Washington Post. Paul Faree, Sean Spicer claimed to be unaware of Seth Rich's story after meeting with donor who pushed it. His being unaware, which is, I think, a polite way of saying he may have lied or at least dissembled, that was in front of the White House press, was it not?
That's correct. In mid-May, Sean Spicer was asked about these allegations that Fox News was reporting, and he said he had no awareness, couldn't comment on it. It wasn't his place to say anything about such a story. But in fact, what we know now is that in April, Sean Spicer met with Rod Wheeler and Ed Butowski to talk about this story. Those two facts don't square clearly. Sean Spicer knew about this. The White House today in the press briefing said that it was an innocent meeting, that Sean Spicer took it as a courtesy to Ed Butowski, whom he knows. He had no idea that they were going to talk about this conspiracy story. Nevertheless, Spicer has to square the fact that he says he had no awareness when, in fact, a month earlier he had met with these two men.
And again, I'm speaking with Paul Faree, who's the Washington Post media reporter, whose latest article is Sean Spicer claimed to be unaware of Seth Rich's story after meeting with donor who pushed it. But again, going back to the absurd pizza story of the child sex ring run by Hillary Clinton out of a pizza parlor in Georgetown, that had consequences. This story has already had consequences, hasn't it? At least in terms of the Rich family, whose son was murdered. And that is a painful enough thing on its own. But to have salt rubbed into that wound with these conspiracy theories, didn't they beg Fox, and I suppose by extension, I think WikiLeaks also pushed this story, but didn't they beg these people to cease and desist?
Yes, the Rich family has said repeatedly that there was no connection between their son and any of the release to WikiLeaks. They, in fact, were quite alarmed and upset by the Fox News story. They complained to Fox News about it, and Fox, within a week of publishing these allegations, withdrew the story and retracted the story, saying that it had been published prematurely. But it clear that the Fox story was incorrect and that there is no evidence suggesting that Seth Rich gave anything to WikiLeaks or had any contact with them.
But in effect, what apparently was going on here was that there was an attempt made to shield WikiLeaks from the accusation that they received the DNC information from Russian intelligence. Isn't that the whole point, just to cast doubt on that link, which is certainly damaging and I think has been pretty well established?
Yeah, you trace this conspiracy theory all the way up to the White House, according to Rod Wheeler, that the White House and Sean Spicer may have pushed this story as a way to create a distraction, a counter-narrative to, you know, all of the allegations of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. That's the central thrust of this, that this was a way to take the pressure off the Trump White House. That is an allegation. It is not necessarily clear that that was the case. But Rod Wheeler has alleged that Trump was aware of the conversations between them and Sean Spicer, and that President Trump had urged Fox News to publish this story, even though it was bogus.
And what was the role of WikiLeaks in this? I recall that they were pushing this conspiracy theory as well.
The question is where did WikiLeaks get the emails from the Democratic National Committee that embarrassed Hillary Clinton? Who was the source and what was the source of this? According to this discredited Fox News story, Seth Rich was the source of these emails. However, there is much greater evidence that WikiLeaks received these emails that were legitimately from the DNC's computers, that WikiLeaks received this from Russian hackers, possibly through a middleman, but nevertheless, that the Russian hackers went into the DNC's computers, got the emails, and passed them to WikiLeaks, which published them to the world. WikiLeaks is implicated here, but I don't know that WikiLeaks is saying flat out that our source was Seth Rich.
Well, I believe there's an attempt underway. Senator Grassley's committee is trying to come up with a scenario that the Steele dossier was actually put together by Russian intelligence to embarrass Donald Trump as a way to distract the main story thrust, which is that the Russians were actually trying to hurt Hillary Clinton and help Donald Trump.
Well, let's stick with the facts here. What we know about the Steele dossier is it was put together by a former British intelligence agent named Steele, that it originated with Democratic sources. It originated with Republican candidates trying to dig up opposition research on Donald Trump. And then it was pushed more so by Democratic sources. But nevertheless, let's keep WikiLeaks out of this. This originated in the U.S. By political operatives in Washington.
Sure. But, I mean, I was suggesting maybe there's a pattern here to distract, to suggest, put up. In this case, it's a pretty flagrantly false story meant to suggest that there wasn't a link between Russian intelligence and WikiLeaks.
That's right. That's where we are now. The allegation is that this Seth Rich story was all created. This conspiracy was all created to, undermine the narrative that the Trump campaign had colluded with Russia during the campaign. The Trump campaign would be very happy for people to believe that the emails that embarrassed Hillary Clinton came from from Seth Rich and the DNC, and not from in any way the Trump campaign itself.
So do we know exactly what happened to this young man who was shot on the streets of Washington, D.C., which unfortunately is not an entirely rare thing to happen, right, in terms of random crime?
Well, it's rare for DNC staffers to be murdered in on the streets of Washington, yes. The official story, at least from the district police department, is that this was a botched robbery attempt. They see no evidence that of any connection between Seth Rich and WikiLeaks, or that Seth Rich was even in possession of the leaked emails. As far as they can tell, this was part of a robbery that went bad.
So how far up the chain is this lawsuit going to go in terms of Fox and News Corp?
Well, this isn't the first. It's not the first lawsuit that Fox has faced. As you know, last summer they were peppered with lawsuits over sexual harassment. They have denied the allegations in this lawsuit, they said they are still investigating the circumstances of the discredited story that they published.
But they do have some vulnerability, I believe, with Rupert Murdoch's efforts for his takeover bid for Sky in the UK.
So I don't see how. I mean, I guess this is an allegation. This is not proven. This has not been adjudicated in any way. So we have to wait and see. I guess the only connection to Sky would be this is yet another accusation against Fox on top of the sexual harassment allegations from last summer. But again, you know, it's an allegation. It's not a proven entity here.
Right, but if the issue with Sky is whether or not Fox as a company is fit and proper to own this British broadcasting very, very powerful organization, or make it more powerful and own more of it, the fact that they had pushed a fake story and then retracted it, in journalistic terms, that doesn't look good, does it?
Well, you'd have to know that they knew the story was bogus, that they were aware that it was not true and published it anyway. I don't see any evidence that that's the case. The story was certainly flawed. The story was certainly incorrect, and they've acknowledged that by withdrawing it and retracting it. But did they know it was wrong? I can't say that I know that.
Right. Well, so do you think then that this is going to ever come to trial? Will Sean Spicer, I mean, the fact that the president himself's been implicated has obviously made some headlines. What's your sense of where this is heading?
I can't predict the future. It's obviously a lawsuit that's been brought by a gentleman who was a Fox contributor. I would also say that it's his lawyer is experienced because he's represented some of the plaintiffs in the sexual harassment allegations against Fox. So he knows Fox well. Whether it gets to trial is still up in the air. We're only hours into the accusations here.
But what kind of injury can the plaintiff Wheeler, what can he present? How has he been impacted by pushing this false narrative?
Well, this is a defamation suit, and he claims that Fox, in its retracted story, made up quotes and attributed them to him. So he feels that his reputation has been damaged by these false quotes. Fox is saying that this is completely erroneous, that this actually is not the case, and there's no evidence that he was misquoted. So, again, you've got two sides making counter accusations.
Well, I thank you for walking us through. As I said, it's a little Byzantine.
Yes, but, it truly is.
But I thank you for your reporting, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ann.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Fahey, who is the Washington Post media reporter, whose latest article is Sean Spicer claimed to be unaware of Seth Rich's story after meeting with donor who pushed it. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the extent that Donald Trump might go to sabotage the Affordable Care Act.
How tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. All we got, no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Gerald Kaminsky, a professor of health policy and management and director of the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research, whose current research focuses on evaluating the impacts of healthcare reform. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gerald Kaminsky.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure.
Well, thank you for joining us, Gerald. And what do you make of this? I mean, there's no secret that Donald Trump keeps, it's almost a constant refrain that the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is collapsing. It's collapsing. It's collapsing. When it's not collapsing, we know that. I mean, it's got problems, but it's survived remarkably. So given the 7 years assault on it by the Republican Congress and the recent failure of the Republicans to kill it, even though for them there was an awful lot on the line. So in fact, the evidence out there is quite the opposite to the idea that it's collapsing. It's showing extraordinary resilience in the face of a relentless assault.
Well, I agree with you. I think that, you know, this president is intent on erasing this law. And, you know, it's not just him. Republicans have campaigned. This has been a lightning rod. This Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, for 7 years has helped mobilize Republican base. It's given them something to focus their energy on. And so, you know, numerous candidates in the House and Senate have campaigned to promising to get rid of this horrible law as they describe it. And, you know, the evidence is that it, by all measures, that it's the law is benefiting millions of Americans who did not have health insurance. And yes, it is not a perfect law. It could be better. But if the goal is to provide quality health care, let's start with what's working and fix what isn't working. Instead, the Republicans, including their attempts last week, seem to be focused on one objective only, and that is cutting government spending programs that benefit low and middle income Americans. And that's all that this has been about. This is not about health care. This is about reducing federal government spending.
Well, but it also involves a tax cut for the wealthy, does it not? At the expense of removing subsidies for health care that poor people before Obamacare didn't have access to. Something like 20 million people we're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, and it depends on which version of the which bill would have passed, because the House bill would have repealed all Obamacare taxes, and that would have been a tremendous windfall to individuals above $200,000, as individual filers and couples above $250,000. Tremendous windfall for them. But Senate bill was you know, not quite as generous and didn't repeal those taxes. So it still would have repealed quite a few taxes and that go to support the subsidy. So, you know, these bills would have achieved and been consistent with conservative positions about smaller government and putting health care back in the hands of individuals, et cetera, et cetera. But when you look past the ideology and all the rhetoric, really what they're doing is just limiting and cutting federal government spending, pushing the responsibility onto others regardless of the consequences.
But we understand why Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan and the Republicans have tried to repeal and replace Obamacare, because they invested 7 years in demonizing it. Now, of course, Donald Trump has demonized it too, and he did so on the campaign trail. But do you think Trump also has this, he seems to have this obsession about Obama. Anything that Obama did, he has to destroy or undo. So what is it with Trump? Is he out of the same hymnal as Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, or does he have this burning animus against Obama?
Well, I'm not sure I'm the best person to comment on that. My degree's in public policy, not in psychology. But I think that his obsession with trying to erase all aspects of the previous administration is not something unique to him. I was watching a news program this morning where Senator Lindsey Graham, when asked a direct question about whether President Trump is diminishing the stature of the United States presidency, first avoided the question completely, and then went with a follow-up saying, "You didn't answer my question. Could you please answer the question?" Said, "Well, you know, a lot of people think that the previous president did that too. So I guess it just depends on your perspective." Now, that was a completely gratuitous attack on President Obama that had nothing to do with the question that was being asked, but he immediately pivoted to criticizing the former president, saying he tarnished the office, creating a false equivalency that I think Republicans have been, many Republicans, not just the current president, have been harping on for the last 8 to 9 years. So it is a sad state of affairs that when the party in power is has no positive message and no positive policy prescriptions, that they can always go back and fire up the base by criticizing the former president and carting out these arguments that help get them elected but aren't really helping them govern the country.
Well, it's almost as if they didn't win the election. I mean,
they're still campaigning, aren't they?
It's so bizarre that he's got this obsession with beating up on Obama and relitigating his so-called victory over Hillary Clinton. It's a little surreal. So there was an article, Gerald, in Tuesday's Los Angeles Times, an op-ed by Nicholas Bagley, a professor of law at the University of Michigan, titled, "Here's How Trump Could Sabotage Obamacare." And it is a little alarming. There are lots and lots of ways that that Trump can fulfill this kind of create the reality that he has projected. In other words, he's gone on this jihad against Obamacare, saying it's collapsing when it's not. But he has the tools at hand to actually sabotage it and do a lot of damage, if not help collapse it.
Well, he's already done that just by his constant sort of drumbeat against it. So what it does is it creates a certain amount of uncertainty in the market and in the public's mind about whether or not this law is going to be in effect and whether it's already been repealed in some way. There are, some people who believe that it's been repealed already just because Congress has considered repealing it. So he himself is helping to destabilize the marketplace just with his rhetoric, and that's kind of the president's bully pulpit. But the lever that he has in his hands that was in the LA Times editorial today has to do with the cost sharing reductions, and the cost sharing reductions are a part of the law that provide subsidies not to individuals but directly to insurance companies to lower the copayments and deductibles for people at the lower end of the income scale within exchanges like Covered California. So if you're a family with or an individual below 250% of the poverty level, which for an individual is about $30,000 and for a family of four is about $61,000. If you're below that level, you can, and you select a silver plan, you can get not only a subsidy to buy the plan, but then your copayments and your deductibles are lower than they would be for somebody else who's buying a silver plan but with higher income. And this provides tremendous benefit. At the lowest end, it reduces your copayments as low as about $8 per visit compared to $50 for somebody who doesn't qualify for these cost-sharing reductions. So the president has the authority to continue making these payments, and it's partly because the House sued President Obama back in 2014 regarding the legality of these payments. It's apparently in the original law, the appropriation of these cost-sharing reductions was not clearly specified, even though they're clearly identified in the law. And as a result, there are legal challenges about their constitutionality. The bottom line is that President Trump right now has the authority to continue them until Congress decides whether or not it wants to clarify the uncertain or questionable status of these payments. And he's signaling, and the latest that I've read in the last hour is that he's going to announce this week that he's not going to continue these payments. Now, that's going to have a devastating impact on markets around the country. Here in California, where rates were released today by Covered California, they've said that if the cost-sharing reductions are not provided by the federal government, people who choose silver plan, the, premium for silver plans will go up an additional 12.5% next year. That's on top of the average 12.3% premium increase that was already announced. So this is going to make those plans much less attractive. And for people below 250%, it's going to make those plans less affordable. Not so much when you buy the plan, but when you actually go to use it and you have to pay a $50 copayment for an office visit, or you know, higher copayment when you go for lab work.
So, in other words, President Trump's going to actually take an axe to it because he has an easier way, because the House Republicans filed a lawsuit during the Obama presidency, arguing that that they shouldn't appropriate this money for these subsidies for the low income customers of from health paid directly to health insurers. And a federal judge agreed with them, but then the judge's decision was put on hold to allow for an appeal. So all Trump has to do is to drop the appeal. But you're saying he's actually going to stick his neck out and take a sledgehammer to it.
Well, it's the one lever that he has, and it looks like he's going to play it. Again, these are reports that I've been reading in the last hour or so coming out of D.C. from healthcare reporters. So, these are reliable sources that I trust, sure. And it would be perfectly consistent with what he has been saying since last week when the latest repeal and replace efforts went down in flames. So, this is the big lever that he has. This is the big stick, and it will cause disruptions in the marketplace. There is no question whatsoever. I think the gamble is that he is gambling that when the consequences of his actions begin to unfold in the marketplace, that people are going to blame President Obama. And his supporters and the people who voted for him may, in fact, do that. But I don't think it's a majority of people in the country, and I don't think it's a majority of people who are going to be hurt by this action.
Well, it's surprising because there's so many things that he can do through kind of malignant neglect, if you will. Cutting or refusing to sort of publicize the healthcare exchanges, screwing with the IT. There's a whole bunch of things that he could do behind the scenes to sort of grind up the gears and slow walk it to death. But he's taking a real gamble there, as you pointed out. And my sense is that I agree with your interpretation. I think people will see this as a rather cruel act. And it is, isn't it? Isn't it cruel and callous? It's unnecessary. I mean, why? There's still no replacement out there, and I recall on the stump, Donald Trump, on many occasions said, "We're going to just get rid of Obamacare, and what you're going to get is it's going to be so fabulous. You're going to have lower premiums and better care, and it's just going to be fabulous and great and all that stuff." None of that.
Yeah, we still haven't seen that plan, and
you're right.
I suspect that plan is not forthcoming, and using this threat is not going to make that plan suddenly emerge. The fact is that I think that, he's either about to learn a very important political lesson, which is that you can only continue to demonize the past administration for so long, and then you have to accept responsibility for your actions and the direction of the country.
Sure.
Or he's going to be proven right once again in his bold assertion which is that, I can basically do anything, and people are not going to hold me accountable. They'll, in fact, not only not hold me accountable, they'll elect me to be the leader of the country.
Mm.
And I have impunity to do just about anything now. I lived through the Nixon years, and even he learned that he was not above the law. But I don't know what it's going to take, how many transgressions and complete disregard for a majority of Americans, much less authorizing potentially illegal activities it's going to take before this president is held accountable.
Well, you know, the, of course, Harry Truman had that famous sign on the desk in the Oval Office, the buck stops here. And that's surely the opposite of what we're experiencing in this 6 months of chaos.
Unfortunately, the buck does stop at the Oval Office, but it's not the responsibility that Harry Truman was talking about. It's the dollars flowing into his pocket.
Right.
But
there is something going on here. I mean, it's so obvious that the Republicans and the Democrats, as Senator McCain said when he cast that fateful vote, let's get back to regular order and work together. You know, if they wanted to fix the Republicans, they wanted to fix the Affordable Care Act and stop this kind of jihad, the Democrats made it clear that they're willing to work. Well, the Republican chair has joined with Patty Murray, and they're talking about setting up a bipartisan group of senators.
Right.
I'm talking about Lamar Alexander.
That's been reported this afternoon, and I think that cooler heads are going to prevail on this, because I think that we've seen they're not going to be able. There's no path forward in the repeal and replace options that are on the table. So I think that Republicans are recognizing that a bipartisan approach is actually going to work for them. It's going to help them preserve the aspects of the Affordable Care Act that they like. And in many cases, that means the Medicaid expansion. And then they can work to find compromise solutions to keep the premiums in the exchanges more reasonable and work with Democrats to find a way to achieve that.
Yeah, I spoke the other day, General Kaminsky, with James Moroney, a healthcare specialist at Brown University, who talked about the Medicaid program. And he was suggesting that might be a better model than Medicare for All, which a lot of people feel is inevitable in terms of moving to single payer once we finally figure out that the insurance people simply should not be in the healthcare business. They don't bring anything to the table. They just charge overhead. They're parasites and middlemen. And it's and even, you know, all of these plans and Obamacare, et cetera, at the end of the day, are tinkering with something that's inherently flawed. And the rest of the world operates by and large on single payer. We're spending 18% of our GDP, and other countries do it for about 8%. So, and right next door in Canada, it works, and it works in Australia. So that's something that's out there. What do you think of that theory that Medicaid actually may be a better building block than Medicare to move eventually to single payer?
So I'm not sure that I agree with that prescription, but I do think that Medicaid can serve as an important role in first of all, as a public option in areas where if we can't make private insurance, I should say the exchange markets or the ACA subsidies, attractive enough to private insurance companies in certain areas of the country, then I think opening up state Medicaid programs to allow people in areas that are not served by private insurers because they've decided that it's just not profitable enough for them and that they can't be bothered in a market where they're not making profits or enough profit, then opening the Medicaid program in those counties seems to me a legitimate option. I think that ultimately Medicare for All of some sort is the right model for single payer for the following reason. Medicaid across most of the country is largely managed care at this point. And going back to the Clinton effort to reform healthcare in the United States, one of the features of Clinton's reform bill that sealed its fate was that it would require individuals to sign up for health plans in insurance marketplaces, much like the exchanges we have today, but they would, the options would be HMOs. And at that, and you know, at that point in time in 1993 and 1994, HMOs were viewed as the way to control healthcare spending in the United States. That we were, you know, putting all our eggs in that basket, and so the Clinton reform was based on an HMO model, and it was one of the reasons there was you know, sort of popular revolt against it. Not to mention, you know, stakeholder revolt. So because Medicaid, in not only in California but across the country, is largely managed care, I'm not sure that, you know, I think there might be a similar sort of backlash if people only had an HMO as an option, mm-hmm. whereas the Medicare program offers many different options at this point, including fee-for-service medicine if you stay in traditional Medicare, Medicare Advantage, which is largely HMO, but includes some PPO options. So, anyway.
Well, let me just quickly, in the last minute or two here, turn to the story that came out today where here in California, the covered California premiums, and after all, California has been one of the more successful states in terms of implementing the Affordable Care Act, with its own exchange, of course, that covered California premiums will rise by an average of 12.5%, and that Anthem Blue Cross announced its plans to end its Affordable Care Act coverage in most of California. So just if you wouldn't mind quickly commenting on that news today.
Yeah, so the roughly 12.3% increase on average, covered California's own report releasing the rates, said that about roughly 7% of that is related to increases in medical cost. They attribute almost 3% of the increase to just insurer uncertainty about what's going on in the market. So insurers are building in a little bit of a buffer because of the ongoing sort of turmoil in D.C. And then another 2.8% roughly is attributable to the new tax on health insurance premiums that goes into effect in 2018 that was part of the Affordable Care Act but was delayed. So, you know, overall, when you look at those three components, they're all, you know, it all sort of makes sense. There's been no indication of a change in the underlying mix of the risk pool. It's been pretty stable in California, and in fact, as data that they provided suggests that it's lower in California than almost anywhere else in the country. So we have a, you know, a healthy, relatively healthy mix of people in the exchange, and that helps keep costs lower than in other areas of the country. But that's, you know, double-digit increases are still, you know, most people's salaries and wages are not going up double digits. And so it becomes more of a challenge, particularly for people who are not receiving subsidies.
Well, General Kaminsky,
a percentage of the market,
sure.
But still.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it, General Kaminsky.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with General Kaminsky, who's a professor of health policy and management and director of the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research, whose current research focuses on evaluating the impacts of healthcare reform. We're going to take a brief station break and be back assessing the fallout from last week's ousting of Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now, Sujan Nawaz, who is the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within, a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst. Now, Sujan Nawaz has also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. He is the former director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sujan Nawaz.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you.
Good to talk to you again, Sujan. And what do you make of the some people are saying it's a sort of a some kind of a soft coup. Last week, the Prime Minister of Pakistan was forced out of office. He's got a year to go in his tenure. It's not the first time this has happened with elected civilian leaders, but is there the hand of the military in this somewhere, even though the actual ousting was done through the Supreme Court on the basis of evidence that emerged from the Panama Papers that came out in a corruption scandal last year?
More complicated than that, Ian, and if you allow me, I'll give you a little bit of background about it. The Supreme Court had received a report from a joint investigative team that was joint in nature, which meant that it included both civil and military officials who had conducted their own forensic examination of the Panama Papers, as well as other issues related to the elections that were held in 2013 when Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif was re-elected as Prime Minister for the third time. The joint investigation team had presented its findings to the Supreme Court. The full bench of the Supreme Court looked at those findings and decided to break them into two parts, one dealing with matters relating to the 2013 election, and the others related to potentially criminal activities arising out of the Panama Papers, meaning hiding of assets, increase of wealth, income without an adequate explanation of where the money came from, and so on. And they passed all the criminal investigation over to the National Accountability Bureau and suggested that they conduct its further investigation within 60 days and then complete the cases that they were sent forward by the Supreme Court within 6 months. So all the criminal activity was not decided upon by the Supreme Court. They looked at what was it that happened in the elections, and they decided on the basis of the information they'd been given that Prime Minister Sharif had not been truthful in declaring the fact that he, in fact, was employed as a paid chairman of a company based in Dubai. And this had not been declared, and therefore he had been dishonest. And under the terms of Articles 62 and 63 of the Constitution, that he could be disqualified from being prime minister. The government remains. His party remains in power. It's simply he who has been disqualified, as well as other members of his family, as well as other people associated with the government. But the primary government of Pakistan, Muslim League, Nawaz Group, as it's called, remains in power, and they've in fact today elected a prime minister who is a member of his party.
But specifically, he's been ousted by the Supreme Court for withholding his Dubai-based employment information, which he failed to put in full into his nomination papers for the 2013 general elections. I mean, I must say that's a little bit like what we're hearing from Jared Kushner and some of the Trump people that, you know, on their forms that they have to fill out for intelligence clearances, et cetera, that they failed to mention various meetings with the Russian ambassador, etc. So they're not even getting a slap on the wrist. So would you put that into in a broader context? Is this really a grave infraction?
Well, it is an infraction, and it was part of a larger packet. They've sent the rest of the packet to the National Accountability Bureau to be tried. But there's a history to the use of these clauses to disqualify members of parliament. And there have been not only prime ministers, but members of parliament, various individuals who have been sent home because it was discovered that they had finagled on their paperwork, not made adequate declarations, and so on. So it's not as if he was singled out for it. The other question that for which no evidence has yet been presented, although there's been a lot of claims that the military was behind it, the military may well have wanted to have removed his predecessor, Mr. Zardari, when he was in power. They had the possibility a number of times, and they were unable to or unwilling to do that. I have not yet seen evidence that there was a military influence over the court in this particular case. I'd like to see the glasses half full, and I'd like to see the possibility that maybe the judiciary is exercising its role. I must say there is an irony in all of this, and the irony is that the final twist which was applied to these two articles of the Constitution, which have been in different constitutions of Pakistan since the 50s, was put by General Ziaul-Haq, the military dictator, who was the mentor and, in fact, the political creator of Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. He helped him getting to politics, made him in charge of the Punjab, and then eventually become a prime minister after Zia's death on the basis of the support he'd received from the military. It was Zia who introduced these religious moral aspects to these two articles mm-hmm. that talked about people being honest and being religious and so on. And those were then applied in the case of Prime Minister Sharif. So there's a delicious sort of irony in all of this.
And again, I'm speaking with Shuja Nawaz, who is the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army and the Wars Within, a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political strategic analyst. Shuja Nawaz has also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, and he's the former director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. But the fact remains, though, Shuja, that not a single prime minister of Pakistan in its history has completed their five-year tenure so far. So there is a history here of government army interference.
You're absolutely right, because the civilian tenures have been broken by military coup d'etats. And that has been a major factor. But apart from that, I think the big question really is, was the government dismissed? And the government is there and is likely to complete its five-year term. But even in parliamentary democracies, even in England, you don't necessarily have a full term for a prime minister. As you know, the prime minister can call an election at any time he feels. And he can be dismissed if he makes a mess of things earlier than the five years or 4 years or whatever the terms are in different countries that are following the Westminster model. So I don't subscribe to the theory that term limits are sacrosanct. I think I'm looking at this more as a system that is learning its way, that is, in fact, fighting through an undergrowth of various amendments to the constitutions that have been put through. There was an opportunity for Prime Minister Sharif when the 18th Amendment of Pakistan's constitution was passed, which reduced the powers of the president, specifically his powers that could lead to the dismissal of prime ministers at will, which is what was happening before. It was suggested to Prime Minister Sharif at that time that these particular aspects of Article 62 and 63 could also be eliminated at that time. He chose not to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's isn't it? You mentioned the irony earlier. There's another irony that the person who considered to be the beneficiary of this ousting is Imran Khan, the cricket star, and his party. Of course, he's had a long campaign against Sharif, but he's also often described as somebody that might be a kind of stalking horse for the army. But he himself is battling disqualification, a disqualification case before the Supreme Court under Article 62 and 63, the same clauses that did in Nawaz Sharif.
Exactly. And he's also facing an inquiry under the Panama Gate, so-called Panama Gate scandal, because he has acknowledged that he had offshore accounts. And obviously those were set up to avoid taxes. So I don't think anyone is really immune from this. There is another aspect to this which I think is being ignored within Parliament itself. The political parties have all refused to overturn a law that was passed by Parliament that, in fact, prohibits members of any political party from voting his or her conscience. So they cannot cross party lines to vote. If they do, they are supposed to be debarred from Parliament and lose their seats immediately. This was the 18th Amendment that allowed them to set up this bar on people exercising their right to vote as they pleased. The 14th Amendment, and this was passed by Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif when he was in power. Mm-hmm. So all of this is now churning in Pakistani politics, and I think it's not good for the country because it needs to settle its economic house, bring it in order, and it needs to set up better relationships with its neighbors, which are all in a shambles. And so all this political confusion and uncertainty doesn't bode well for Pakistan.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Shuja Nawaz, and filling us in on this latest upheaval.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Shuja Nawaz, who's the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. He is a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst. Shuja Nawaz has also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, and he is the former director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.